I'm here with Mercedes Doretti from the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team, a.k.a.
Equipo Argentino de Antropología Forense, EAAF.
So, what is the EAAF?
It is a team, it's a non-governmental organization that works primarily on the application of forensic anthropology and archaeology to the investigation of human rights cases. And it was founded in Argentina exactly 20 years ago in 1984 as a response to try to find the remains of the people who disappeared on the last military government.
So that was the initial crisis that inspired the foundation of the organization?
Right, exactly.
What kinds of things does your organization do?
Well, the work normally is divided into three steps. We do what we call the preliminary investigation, which involves the collection of all the historical information about the case that we work in, like testimonies of survivors, of witnesses, documental evidence such as cemetery records, judiciary, military, police records, medical examiner's office records, and all that is called also the antemortem or premortem information, which basically consists on the physical information of the victims when they were alive, so that we can compare later that information with the one that we obtain in the laboratory when we analyze the remains and try to identify them. The second step is the archaeological one, and the third one is the laboratory one. So on the archaeological one, we, of course, try to recover the evidence as it is documented. As we all know, once you work on a site, the site doesn't exist anymore afterwards. So, of course, we're very careful on documenting everything that we found in the place in situ, how the way we found it, and be sure that it gets transported and recorded properly when it gets to the laboratory.
Who pays for your work?
The team is mostly funded by foundations from the United States and from Europe, although we also receive money sometimes from individuals as well from European governments.
Where else have you worked?
By now, the team have worked in more than 30 countries, primarily in Latin America, and also in Africa, a little bit in Asia, and also in Europe, particularly on the Balkan region.
In your experience, what project stands out for you? Can you give an example of a project that represents the kind of service you provide?
What we always try to do, in addition to actually to do a case, to do the exhumation and identification of people, we try to do training as well of local professionals. One of our goals at the team is also to have a more long-term effect of our work by training local people that may be interested in continuing the work. And this is for several reasons, partly because in countries that had massive human rights violations, the work takes decades, frankly. And what we could do, it's very little. If we, you know, we can go a few times a year, but then, you know, in cases like that, you need permanent teams that will be there, you know, working every day. And the other reasons, of course, are that, in principle, we think it's better if each of us take care of what's going on in our own countries. There's a similar culture, similar language, etc., and there's more chances of being able to do a better job.
Could you describe a project that really stands out for you?
For example, one of the projects that we worked for several years was in El Salvador, the massacre of El Mozote, which is the largest massacre documented that occurred during El Salvador 12-year civil war. There, in December 1981, approximately 800 people were allegedly killed by the Salvadorian forces. And these were all civilians that live in six different hamlets. One of them was El Mozote. And so we, working with a local non-governmental organization there, which is the way we normally do it, we were introduced by them to a local judge and then to a special United Nations commission that investigated the case. We were nominated as expert witnesses, and we start doing all the three different steps that I mentioned before. And then the results, we just finished that work after several years of coming and going, and we recovered the remains of half of the number of the people who died. And those all those remains were returned to the families and communities for them to rebury them properly, and we produced different reports to the judge that was in charge of the case.
How are your forensic reports used?
Well, that varies enormously on actually things that are beyond our own work, which is the political situation, the political will to how far to go on these cases. We work only on human rights cases, and as a result, these cases are often submitted to a curtail of receiving the same treatment as a normal crime will be, and they are often subjected to amnesty laws. So we work on each case exactly in the same way, but how much of our evidence is going to be used to prosecute, for example, people, depends, frankly, if there is or not an amnesty law. So in some countries, we've been able to testify orally. People have been put in jail that were found guilty of these crimes, and of course, our report was part of the evidence taken into account. However, I have to say, in most countries, this is not the case. Most gross human rights violations go unpunished in most of our countries.
Do you also use film?
We do. Actually, we photograph and try to video record as much as we can of the work that we do. Not only the archaeological sites, but also the work at the laboratory and the interviews with survivors and families and anybody relevant for the case.
In what ways are films powerful tools to communicate your work?
Well, for example, we have an agreement with a United States-based NGO called Witness that actually provides video services and cameras for human rights organizations around the world. And in addition to that, just a year and a half ago, we were able to complete with them a film that is called Following Antigone, Forensic Anthropology and Human Rights Investigations. And it's basically showing all the different steps involved in this kind of work when you use it on human rights investigations and how different it is from a normal criminal investigation, and with footage that we've been taking in 5 different countries. And these have been an extremely useful tool that we're using in several countries to show it to families of victims, associations of human rights organizations, judges, prosecutors, international tribunals, for them to, in 40 minutes approximately, get a general overview about how forensic anthropology and archaeology and forensic sciences in general can contribute to their cases. And that, for us, it's been working very well.
Do you have relationships with other nonprofit archaeological organizations?
Yes, indeed, particularly since 2 years ago. We are part of the Latin American Forensic Anthropology Association, ALAF, which nucleates all the different non-governmental archaeology and forensic anthropology teams in Latin America, particularly the 3 that exist right now in Guatemala and newly formed in Colombia, 3 different teams in Peru, members of a forming team in Chile, ourselves in Argentina, and then individuals from other Latin American countries.
What do you foresee your organization doing in the years to come?
We will continue doing work in different parts of the world and do training as well. What we're trying to enforce mostly are 2 particular areas at this point. One is what we're calling the documentation center, which is precisely the videos that I was mentioning before, but also in the photo archive. We have photographs from the last 20 years that we want to preserve them because they all refer to historical cases, and also organize them in a way so that they will be more accessible for the public for whenever people ask us for this kind of material. But the other main thing that we want to do is give back to the affected communities where we work books and materials, videos and photos that they can use and have on their local public libraries. We realized over the years that particularly when the communities that are affected are from the rural areas, they rarely have material in their schools of their own history of these investigations. They know, of course, the general conclusions of them, but they don't have, and they have told us this, for the new generations that have not lived through that. And I'm asking them, what happened here? Why half of my family died during the war? Why they disappeared? Or things of that sort. There isn't material there to tell that part of the story sometimes. But at least on the forensic side, what we're doing is starting to prepare books, both in a more popular edition and on a more academic edition, to give back to these countries and communities so that this can also be part of what we have to return to them, I think, that we have the obligation to do. The other area that I would like to really emphasize is access to DNA analysis for human rights cases. We saw that in the tragic events here in September 11 in New York, there was an amazing and extraordinary effort to identify every victim and every piece of remains that we'll find, and that was absolutely fantastic. That it's not what happened in most of the cases of human rights victims. DNA is available, but it's still very expensive. We don't have the research to get it. And when it comes to extracting DNA from skeletal material, very few laboratories actually have experience in doing that. So that's one area that we want to improve during the next years.
Do you see a time when your services no longer are needed?
That'd be great. I have many projects I'd like to work on once that happens. Yeah. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. We are more and more busy. Also, sometimes, you know, extending our services to cases that are not necessarily involving human rights, like the 2 tsunami right now, where we have received several requests to send people, basically because of the experience we had here on human rights cases, to use it in this massive natural disaster. And in addition to that, frankly, what we're seeing is that sometimes perpetrators are getting wiser about how to hide evidence, but the crimes keep on being committed. So we have more tools to fight them on the scientific side, and I think on the international law as well. But cases keep on occurring, unfortunately, all the time.
Does your work give you a unique perspective on the source of and the solution to global conflict?
I think, frankly, the way I see it is that we're part of a chain of people and organizations that are working on the same direction. Our perspective is the recovery of physical evidence, which I think it's made a major contribution in the last 20 years, adding to the testimonial evidence. Before, most groups were, like Amnesty International and other major human rights organizations, were basing their cases on testimonies, basically, of victims and survivors and witnesses. Now to that, we can add physical evidence. And I think to a large extent, forensic anthropology and archaeology had contributed enormously.
What is the source of global conflict?
That's not a very easy question.
No.
I guess it varies from country to country. You know, we deal with the aftermath of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some conflicts are sometimes labeled as ethnic conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
I, most of the time, don't think they are simply ethnic conflicts. I think they beyond, at least the ones that we worked on, there's always political and economic reasons, as in most conflicts all over the world. And it's just that in some cases there is, in addition to that, an ethnic division that reinforced those conflicts.
You are one of the few organizations in the world that uses the archaeological method in projects of social justice.
Right.
In what other situations could archaeology be used in projects of social justice?
We use it on human rights cases. In other cases, sometimes when, for example, developers want to build, for example, as we worked in one case in French Polynesia, a hotel above a local cemetery containing the remains of native people. That was another case where I think archaeology played an important role, and biological anthropology as well, trying to establish the origin of that cemetery, and as a result of that, trying to provide rights for the current native people to have a claim on that. As you may know, this is a big issue also in the United States, have been on the last 10 or 15 years.
Yes.
Creating also legislation regarding that and trying to work a bridge of understanding between the archaeologists also and the Native Americans here in the United States. I think that it's also an area where archaeology and biological anthropology can help to, in cases of social justice in a way, yeah.
Final question. How can we help? How can a young archaeologist be of service to your organization?
I think one of the ways is to be more familiar with this field, to also understand that when you're working on human rights, things are different than when you're working on an archaeological site that has thousands of years old. You have families there that you have to include as part of your work. This is one of the main things that it's different. And also when forensic people that are not used to work on these kind of cases have to work on them, you have to work very close to the families, because in most of these cases, the families have been very neglected and they have been often lied about what happened with their relatives, denied any kind of knowledge, right, or whatever. So one of the main things is to realize that you're working in a context in which you have to go much more beyond your own technical work and understand a number of human and political circumstances
right.
where you have to actually do the work. And then, of course, many archaeologists and anthropologists are helping us as volunteers or as consultants whenever we need more people to work. And they're offering their services, you know, for free or almost for free, just, you know, to cover the expenses. And that is a very generous and very appreciated resource. Also, archaeologists and anthropologists are coming to train their office or to give us updates on different areas of our discipline. And we appreciate that enormously.
Well, you do very important work, Mercedes. Thank you for talking with us today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for calling.